Astronauts, you have followed the manned space program from its very beginnings, and now here's your third flight after your second Mercury flight, July 21st, 1961, Gemini 3 in March of 1965. Now we're to 1967, which is when we rerun the tape, and Apollo 1. What impresses you most about the progress of manned flight throughout these years?
Well, I guess it's become a lot more complicated than it was, but the vehicles are very complex, and the jobs that we plan for them to do are also a very complex and very difficult job. As you know, the Apollo spacecraft is being designed to go to the moon and back, and this is a very difficult job, and so the problems have become complex, and the procedures have become complex.
When you go back to your Mercury mission, what at this point stands out as the highlight of the experience to you? The unknowns at that time?
Oh, yes, I think so. I know I still play the tapes of my Mercury flight, and I get a little choked up, but I can play the tapes of my Gemini flight, and it doesn't seem to have any real feeling like the first Mercury flight did. Those were real unknowns in those days, and even though it was 15 minutes, it was still a great thrill and a great great flight.
And today you're captain of the ship for Apollo 1. Now, speaking of the captain of the ship, I'm reminded of Dr. Charles Berry's description of the captain of the ship syndrome there. Now, I guess we can assume that you're going to be the man who's all business and making all those decisions, that you're going to be the most serious man on this flight, huh?
Well, I don't know about that.
I facetiously put
that. We have a well-trained crew. We work well together, and I guess the basic decision-making is my responsibility, but still I would have to lean heavily on both Roger and Ed for any decisions that are made, because they're both experts in certain fields, and when you make a decision, you want all the best information you can get.
And the mission is so complex, you need all of that backup, right?
That's right. It's almost too complex for one man to know everything and be able to do everything. It takes a team.
Going back again, what would you outline your personal experiences in training and activity here in the astronaut program since your Mercury flight? Well, first of all, you did train for Gemini 3. Would you just review the things you've been doing in the last two or three years?
Well, since Gemini 3, I've been working primarily on this flight. I had a short period in there when I was back up for Gemini 6 with Wally, which was still a Gemini flight. But since coming to the Apollo program, I've been doing essentially the same things I did in Mercury and Gemini. I started living with the spacecraft, going into great detail on how it was checked out, what procedures were used, and exactly how it was done, going into developing the flight plan, developing the flight procedures, developing malfunction procedures, and essentially the same sort of thing that I've done two times before.
Mm-hmm. How has your personal life changed, the life of you and of your family, since the Mercury days?
Well, I seem to get busier all the time, and I find that I'm home less and less. And since being on the Apollo flight, I've been gone probably 5 days out of every week. I get home on a weekend, spend one day in the office, and one day at home, and then leave that afternoon is about the way it's been going.
Has public demand on your time changed much in these years?
Well, back before the Mercury flight, there wasn't any public demand on my life.
Now you're famous.
Well, I guess. But when we're assigned to a flight crew, we do very little as far as the public is concerned. We're very busy trying to get a flight off, and so those demands are met by someone else who is not quite so busy.
Thank you, Gus Grissom. That's the end of one little vignette. Now, can you do some mission description? Can you just give me a 3 or 4 minute...
Let me go get a Coke or something.
Yeah, okay.
I'm thirsty.
Hold it. Okay. Gus, would you review for us the overall purposes of Apollo 1, what very often we call the mission description?
Well, the basic mission of Apollo 1 is a test flight on the whole spacecraft itself. And
did I say 1 or 201? Did I say 1?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I thought I had goofed, so start over.
Well, did I say 201?
No, you said I'll start the question again. Well, Gus, would you review for us the overall purposes of Apollo 1 and describe the mission?
Well, the Apollo 1 mission basically is to be a test flight of all the systems on board. We want to exercise them all in all of their normal modes and as many of their backup modes as possible so that the next flights could go on with the learning and with the testing that has to be done in order to get the spacecraft to the moon and back. I guess the big things on a flight really are the SPS burns that are to be made, and we have 8 of those scheduled in.
Over SPS, that's the Service Propulsion System?
That's right.
We're learning some new alphabet numbers
here. Well, we always have to scatter in a bunch of letters, you know.
You wouldn't be an engineer if you didn't.
That's true. But this big Service Propulsion Engine is the means by which we'll get primarily back from the moon. So it has to work. We have 8 burns scheduled on this flight, each about spaced about 40 hours apart, burning in all of its modes. So this is probably the highlight of the flight. If we can get all of those off satisfactorily, it would be a really great flight.
When you say we will burn it in all of its modes, we will fire the big rocket engine in a number of different manners or directions,
well,
is that?
In a number of different ways of controlling it, actually. The guidance and navigation system can control it. We have a stabilization control system on board, which is separate from the guidance and navigation. That can control it. And then we can control it manually also.
Mm-hmm.
So we have 3 basic modes to fire it, and we'll burn it in all those modes.
Now, another important aspect of the flight is this very complex and important new guidance and navigation system, isn't it?
Yes, the guidance and navigation system is the heart of the spacecraft. And without it, it would be impossible to make it to the moon and back. You just couldn't do it manually. And so we have this checkout to do also to see what bugs are in these programs and see if there are any surprises there that we hadn't counted on.
For people elsewhere in the world who haven't seen pictures of the Apollo spacecraft and the service module, how would you describe what it looks like?
Oh, that's a little difficult for me, I guess. But the total service module and spacecraft must be about 50 feet in length.
Much larger than here before.
Much, much larger than before. And I guess on the order of 12 feet in diameter, something of this sort.
It's still, the spacecraft itself is still bell-shaped, cone-shaped.
Well, the spacecraft is cone-shaped, and the service module is essentially a cylinder. With a large rocket engine on the rear of it.
And this cone-shaped spacecraft is conforming with basic United States designs for reentry vehicles.
Yes, that's right. It's very similar to the Mercury and Gemini vehicle. It's a sharper cone. Well, I'll say not a sharper cone. I guess it's really the included angle is much larger than we've used in the past.
It's a lot roomier inside, too, isn't it?
Oh, much roomier. If I have to take a long-duration flight, which we hope this one is, well, I'm glad it's in this vehicle because we can move around. We have sleep stations under the couches. We have hot and cold water. We have a lot of things that we've never had before.
Well, Gus, the room inside the spacecraft is one of the most imposing differences to previous craft in which you've flown, isn't it?
Yes. In the past, in Gemini, we've had EVA, extravehicular activity. Well, now we have IVA, which is intervehicular activity. We'll be able to float around, and we expect that this will cause us some minor problems, but nothing major, we hope.
Well, now, you were also the checkout pilot for Gemini, the Gemini spacecraft, and you've been given this honor again for the new Apollo craft. Does this mean that your mission is more important for the success of ensuing missions? Do you have to be more astute in watching the new systems and in evaluating them than future pilots will have to be?
Well, no, there's a lot more involved than that. I think one of the things is that I've done in the past and been doing this time is just making certain that the systems are being checked in the manner in which we use them, you know, and that the systems are ready to fly when we go fly. This is actually as important. The work that goes on the ground before the flight is actually as important as as the flight itself.
I remember one of your prominent engineers here at the Manned Spacecraft Center has told me that at one time he questioned why the National Aeronautics and Space Administration felt that it should have test pilots in the early part of its program. And as he worked with you men more and more and more, he gradually began to see how those of you with test pilot backgrounds were so well trained in being astute observers. You were trained because of your aeronautical test backgrounds in evaluating and seeing and hearing and just noticing things that maybe less experienced people or pilots would never see. Well, this is one of the things which has contributed to your participation,
well,
isn't it?
Yes, this is part of it, but you see, it's a little more than that, than being a trained observer. Back early, especially, we tried to get people who had been in test business and who had been in unusual positions and had survived them. And we felt that an individual who had himself in a hostile environment and who had lived through it was probably maybe something a little different about him than people who hadn't been in this sort of environment and would make better observers and a little cooler heads, as we call it, and can think a little clearly and adapt a little more readily than just the ordinary man off the street.
Mm-hmm. As captain of the ship for Apollo 1, you are commanding two other astronauts, Edward White and Roger Chaffee. I wonder if you'd give us your observations on your two crewmen.
Well, they're both outstanding men. And Roger, even though he hasn't flown on a flight, is probably one of the smartest boys I've run into in a long time. He's a brilliant engineer, and he knows the systems on board the spacecraft probably better than any other one man anyplace, including our own spacecraft center in North America. Ed White is the type of guy that gets a job done. My guy, regardless of what's going on, just like in his EVA, if he sets out to do a job, he's going to get it done, and he doesn't let anything stand in his way. So he's a very fine man to have on our crew, I think.
And you have been working together for a year preparing for this flight.
Yes, we've been working very closely together for some time, and we all get along very well.
Roger's one of the youngest men in the astronaut office. Do you think that possibly as one of the junior members, he feels the necessity for just a bit more hard work in order to keep up with the rest
of the team? No, I think Roger's just naturally very hard-working, and he'd work that hard if he was the oldest man in the group.
And that would come in a worldwide special for that. Gus, how do you prepare the Apollo 1 for entry to the Earth? I think we're now calling it entry rather than re-entry with the new systems, aren't we? This is another change.
That seems to be the new word now. Well, starting about 2 to 3 orbits before we intend to re-enter, we'll bring up all of our systems, all the power systems, and align the stable element or the platform on board, which is our basic...
The platform is your guidance system.
Basic guidance system, basic attitude reference system. We'll get that all aligned using stars to align it. And then we'll go into our retrograde attitude, and at the proper time, we'll fire our SPS engine.
That's the big engine
in
the back.
That's the big engine on the back, and we'll fire it a certain delta V or take out a certain amount of our velocity. As soon as that's accomplished, we'll jettison the service module and that big engine, and then we'll just have the command module, a little cone-shaped vehicle, which will re-enter. The re-entry, from the time we fire the engine and until we're down in the water, until we have the main chutes out anyway, is on the order of about 30 minutes. Again, just like in Gemini, this vehicle is controllable as it re-enters. It is a lifting body, And we can extend our flight path downrange, or we can shorten it, or we can go cross-range a good number of miles in order to hit our landing point. Even though this is a new guidance system, and even though it should be better than the one that's on Gemini, I think we'd probably be very fortunate if we hit as close to our planned landing sites as they have been doing on the later Gemini flights, because we recognize that there are some unknowns in the spacecraft. We don't know exactly what our L over D is on the vehicle, which means
lift over drag.
We don't know exactly what that is yet, and we don't know exactly how accurately the computer can predict your position and measure our position and this sort of thing. So these are one of the important things that we expect to find out.
These are the aerodynamic factors which must be proved in flight.
That's correct.
Which you can't do on the drawing board.
That is correct.
Well, now, is the basic system designed to come in at about the same speed or about the same ground track as the Gemini? For instance, where will, assuming a nominal mission, where will you fire the retrograde burn with the SPS, and where do you expect to splash?
Well, the retrograde burn will be fired just about over the west coast of the United States, and we'll land just a little bit south of Bermuda, which is very similar to the Mercury reentries we made. The Gemini reentries were actually a little longer. We started our retro fire back almost at Hawaii.
Yeah.
So this is comes in a little bit steeper, but there's actually very little difference between the two.
A little steeper descent, but the speed from orbit would be about the same.
That's correct.
I believe you're a little farther out in the Atlantic, though, if you're...
That's right. We do go a little farther out in the Atlantic by going out to Bermuda. So there isn't too much difference. Actually, between the time we fire and the time we hit the sensible atmosphere, which we consider 300,000 feet, is about 10 minutes. And then it's about another 15 to 20 minutes from there down to where the parachute is out.
Now, is your splash into the ocean and recovery to be about the same as in the Gemini and Mercury programs?
Yes. At 24,000 feet, we'll put up drogue chutes, which stabilize the spacecraft in a blunt end or heat shield forward position. And then at 10,000 feet, while we put out our three main parachutes, which lower us on into the water then.
When will we have landings in our space program? Other than the landing on the moon itself.
Well, I don't think that we have any specific plans right now for landings. We are still doing some research in this area, and there's some work that's going on. We feel that the important thing is to accomplish the mission that we're after. And the way we get the spacecraft into its orbit and the way we get it down is secondary to getting a mission accomplished. We have to have a job to do first, and the important thing is to do the job. And then, of course, we have to recover the vehicle, but it doesn't really make that much difference right now whether we do it on land or on water. I personally would prefer a land landing, but we don't feel that we can pay the penalty that it would take to put a land landing system on board at this time.
Mm-hmm. Water's supposed to be softer. There's more of it safely out there.
Well, there's a lot of it out there, and it's uniform, where if you're landing on land, well, you have to be aware of ditches and poles and buildings and rocks and trees and this sort of thing. So it means you have to have some form of a terminal guidance system, which we don't have at this time.
Well, good luck on that successful completion of the mission.
Thank you.
And one more little piece just about TV, and I don't want to get it all into the sort of rigmarole I got into yesterday. Although this would be an opportunity to get a light touch in if you can on here.
A light touch?
Well, follow my lead here and we'll see where it goes. I'll throw it out if it bogs down. We're going to have a television camera on. No, I'll say we have, because by the time this plays, you'll be using it or we won't have seen pictures. We have a television camera on board Apollo 1. Transmitting live pictures back of you gentlemen there in orbit. What was the basic research purpose for placing this on Apollo 1?
Well, I think the basic reason for having it on board is we intend to carry one on the lunar missions to transmit pictures back in real time. And this is one of the cameras that's being developed along that line. I think we'll probably find some good uses for it. We expect to use it when we do the transposition and docking maneuver or station keeping maneuver. We think there are probably some interesting things, at least of human interest, that we can show of the crew on board as we eat and float around the spacecraft and this sort of thing. And possibly, we do have a zoom lens on it, possibly we can even get some good pictures of the Earth or the States as we pass overhead. About the only place that we can transmit pictures back is over the United States. That's about, we only have a few stations that can receive the picture.
I believe that the only station here on Earth prepared for processing and getting pictures back to us, the public, would be at Cape Kennedy, so we will only see live pictures of you, as I understand it, when you happen to pass over Cape Kennedy.
I think there are more stations than that can record the picture, but they're the only ones that can record it and transmit it immediately.
Yes, there are very complicated technical equipment problems in making this live television available to the public and getting it back to people overseas, but I do believe that a lot of you in Europe particularly may be able to see some of these live pictures back through the communication satellite system. I'm going to just drop that plug in. One of the research purposes for the TV camera was to check out the S-band transmission system, wasn't it?
Well, that's one of the objectives of our flight, is to check out the S-band transmission system, and the TV picture is transmitted through that system, yes.
Thank you very much, Gus Grissom, and we'll be looking for you on that television from space.
Thank you, Rhett.
And that'll do it.
Okay.
I think that's given me all. I've got these little vignettes that we drop in all over.
Okay.
And good luck to you, sir.
We need it.
God, I hope you can get it. Like you say. Ed White, Gemini 4 was launched on June the 3rd, 1965, and within a day or two, you were America's first astronaut to walk or to go outside in space. What have you been doing since then?
Well, since then, I was the backup command pilot on the Gemini 7 flight.
That was in December of 65, wasn't it?
That's right. I picked that job up shortly after I got back on Gemini 4. It takes about 6 months of preparation, and between June and December was just about a little more than 6 months. So I picked up that job and saw Gemini 7 off the pad and back down. And when I got finished with that job, I was told that I was going to be on the first Apollo flight crew. And since the first of this year, in other words, last January and February, we started our preparations for the training for the first Apollo flight.
So you've spent a year in training for this first manned Apollo mission.
Yes, we've been working on the mission for about a year now.
And what all have you been concentrating on?
Well, it's been different things. Initially, we concentrated on getting a good feeling and a good understanding of the system, so we went right back to school again. And after that, the job of checking out the spacecraft was starting out at North American, our prime contractor in Los Angeles. And we spent a great deal of time out there reviewing with the engineers the procedures for checking out the spacecraft and making sure that from an operator standpoint the spacecraft was checked out correctly. And after that we went into, and about this, really concurrently with that, we worked on developing our procedures for actually operating the spacecraft and working on our checklist. And along the same time, we worked out our water egress procedures. You might have seen the films on that showing how we will get out of the spacecraft when we get onto the water and how we'll be recovered. We've taken the spacecraft now down to the Cape, and we're in the preparation, the final stages. We've run one altitude chamber test on the spacecraft. We'll be running another one, and then the spacecraft will go out onto the pad, and we'll start our final preparations for launch.
Now, you're also quite active in your spare time, whenever you get any, as I understand it. You're also quite active in youth work. Would you tell us something about what you've done around the country?
Well, I haven't been able to. You know, when you get onto a flight crew, you're pretty well withdrawn from these activities. And I haven't had the opportunity to work as closely as I'd like to with the youth groups. I am very interested in our young people and the organizations that permit them their activities, the YMCA and the Boy Scouts and any of the youth organizations. If I have the opportunity and I make the time to participate in giving support to these organizations.
You know, I always think of you and John Glenn together and your interest in America's youth and your influence upon them. I think John is still very active, although he's not in the program.
Well, he is still very interested in the young people. He still does a lot of work with the Scouts and a lot of work with the Freedom Foundation. You know, really, that's our most important product, let's face it, our kids and how we bring them up and their capability to be useful and constructive, productive citizens. I think if we accomplish this job, then, as far as I'm concerned, whatever else we've done is secondary. If our children are raised properly and are able to create a civilized environment for us in our old age, then we've done our job properly. And I think this is probably one of the big benefits of our space program, because it permits the young people to have a definite, tangible goal. They can see the requirements for getting a good education and for keeping themselves physically fit, because they can't participate in these kind of programs unless they develop their mind so that they have a position and can contribute. So I think really our program is, this is probably one of our big points, is giving a creative environment for our children to grow up in.
Thank you, Ed White. We'll be talking to you more throughout the flight. That's just one closeout. Thank you, Ed White. Now stop it a minute, Dawn. Ed White, you're called senior pilot on this Apollo 1 mission. What does that mean, other than that you're sitting in the middle?
Well, I think this all developed from the point we all are pilots, and we all want to be called pilots of some sort. So we tried to think of some kind of nomenclature, and of course there has to be one man designated as the person who would handle the flight, who would command the flight, and he's the command pilot. And if something should happen, a structure has to be set up where the command passes right down, even among three men. And so that's probably the way we came up with the command pilot, senior pilot, and pilot. You might recognize this. This is the same way the Air Force designates its pilots according to their experience levels. The command pilot is an experienced pilot of 15 years experience with commensurate time of flying.
Captain of the ship.
He's a senior aviator. Mm-hmm. And a senior pilot is the next, and the pilot is the starting level in aviators in the Air Force. So we picked command pilot, senior pilot, and pilot. And it does indicate that I'm sitting in the center couch and that my primary responsibility is in the guidance, navigation, and control area of the spacecraft. And consequently, my interests have been heavily with the computer and the inertial system that allows us to align the spacecraft and to make our maneuvers in space.
Well, what do you think of the new guidance system, the new control system in Apollo?
I'll give you a real good opinion of it after we fly. But I do think that it's a very sophisticated system, and it has a great deal of capability. We're just now starting to understand its full capability, I think, because, you know, you mature a system as you go along. You design it and build it, and then you really learn its full capability as you start utilizing the system, and this is what we're doing now. I think we have a fine, sophisticated system. I think it's fully capable of doing the job for us as we add to it. We, of course, don't have a program in our computer capable of going to the moon, but as the flights progress along, the computer program will be expanded to cover the full flight to the moon, and very confident of our system. We have to find out how well we can see the stars out of the spacecraft. You know, we navigate to the moon using the stars, just like navigators did thousands of years ago. They've used the stars for years. We're going to use those same stars, and to use them, we have to be able to see them. We have a telescope, which we call it a telescope, but it has no magnification to it. It has a magnification of one. In fact, it decreases due to the optical properties. It decreases a little bit of the amount that you can see through it, so that we have a big objective to find out how well we can recognize the stars through this telescope, so that we can take a star, I'll put it in the center of our telescope, and then transfer it over to the sextant, which has a very narrow field of view. It has a field of view of 1.7 degrees, so unless we can line it up rather precisely in the telescope and define exactly which star we're looking at, we can't use our sextant and make our fine alignment of our spacecraft. We have to be able to take two stars, measure the angle between them, and then our computer knows which two stars, we tell the computer which two stars we measured, and it knows exactly where they are in space with respect to time, and it tells us where we are then. Mm-hmm. So and this is our method of navigation.
And what amount of time is required for each of these star sightings and use of your computer before you have the answer?
Well, it's a whole sequence that we go through of aligning the spacecraft, and it could take, to do the whole sequence, a matter of 10 or 15 minutes, but if we had maybe a little difficulty with it, it could take a little longer time. So it's a procedure that you have to go through, which within the procedure, taking sightings on the stars is a part of aligning the spacecraft.
Ed is one of the men who's flown in Gemini before and will now be in the larger Apollo spacecraft. Would you compare the two and your comfort inside this as compared to Gemini?
I think you have to compare maybe one of the little small two-seat compact cars, and then you go along and compare that to one of the maybe a big limousine where you can actually sit on the floor if you want or transfer from the front seat to the back seat.
Is that much more roomy?
It really is. It gives us the capability. We can all three get out of the seats and get down in the area where the footrests are, lower the footrests, and we can very comfortably all three of us work in this area at the same time. Or we can put two men under each of the left and the right seats for the sleep station and have one man up in any one of the three seats to watch the spacecraft while the other two sleep. Or we can put a man down in what's called the lower equipment bay, is where the area that I mentioned first, where the three men can, you can push the seats, the leg pans of the seats back, and you could put a man down there. And this is where you use the sextant and the telescope to work the navigation problems out. So we really have six stations in the spacecraft. We have two sleeping stations, three seat stations, and one station down at the lower equipment bay at the navigation station.
Does this give you enough room to have a little privacy if you need it? When you're sleeping, are you out of the way of the remaining pilots and so that you can isolate yourself?
Well, if you try to visualize the location of the seats are located right straight across the center of the spacecraft, and the two sleep stations are underneath the left and the right couch. So naturally, the man sleeping underneath the couch has no interference from the man up in the couch working in the spacecraft, and vice versa. So they are quite separate locations, and they are, if you want to say it, they are somewhat private, as a matter of fact.
Are most of your instruments in work positions then forward of these points?
Well, they're above the seats, mm-hmm. so that you, when you lay in the seats, back in the seats, the most of the operation of the spacecraft is done from this position, and the switches are all located up in this area. Not many switches are down in the lower equipment bay. Well, there are some down there associated with the navigation of the spacecraft. But down underneath the seats, there's not many switches down there. There are some, but those are ones that aren't used too frequently.
And how well can you see out? Is it comparable to Gemini?
I think we have much more capability to see out, because in our particular spacecraft, we have five windows rather than two, and it gives us a full 180 degrees or better field of view. It probably gives us close to a 360 degree field of view. If you were to use the side portholes, you have portholes on the right or the left of the spacecraft, which you can see out to a certain circumference on either side, and then you have the two docking windows that gives you the capability to looking out straight ahead, and then over the center couch is another fairly large window which gives you the capability of looking out along the curved part of the spacecraft. You almost have to see the picture of the spacecraft to visualize these five windows that are located radially around the spacecraft, but it gives us quite a capability to see out.
Thanks, Ed.
One other thing, too, is you...
Take that, all right. Throw that.
Okay, one other area, too, the part that you can't see, the windows are radially 180 degrees around, the area that you can't see out of, specifically out of the windows, the telescope looks out the other side of the spacecraft. So you effectively can look out almost any part of the spacecraft except out back through the heat shield.
Thanks, Ed.
Now let's go into the suitcase.
Ed White, I think you're going to be much more comfortable inside Apollo 1 than you were inside or outside Gemini 4, aren't you?
Well, I think we will be from a standpoint of when we can actually remove our suits. You know, in Gemini 4, I had on that large suit with 22 layers on it, and it was pretty bulky, and I really wasn't too comfortable in it. But if we can determine that the environmental system is adequate in the Apollo, we plan to take our suits off after the first burn. And The first time we fire the big engine, which will change our trajectory somewhat. It'll be the first test of that engine.
When does that come?
Well, it could come if we have a little difficulty getting into orbit. We could use it to put us into orbit or to make a change right initially after we get into orbit to put us into a better orbit. So we could fire it right away. If not, it'll come late in the first day.
And what sort of apparel will you be wearing?
Well, we have a series of things that we'll have to give us a capability, if it's cold, to be comfortable, and if it's warm, to be comfortable. We have an extra pair of the same kind of underwear that everybody else has been wearing. This is a bit for sanitation, too, though. We plan to change that once during the flight. And
now, this is just typical long cotton.
That's
underwear.
Long handles with pockets in it for the electronics that take care of the sensors to monitor our physical condition. We also have a pair of constant wear flight suit, which are a two-piece flight suit designed somewhat similar to a flying suit.
Is this a nylon outer garment?
Well, it's a I don't believe it's all nylon. I believe it has some nylon in it, but it's a space-compatible material. Outer garment, it's blue, and it's the same material as our old blue flying suits were made out of. And in addition to this, we're taking a pair of a two-piece long-handled underwear. And it's a little warmer than regular long underwear. It's almost the thermal type underwear. We'll take that along so that we can put on a top or take off a top. And we'll have a few extra pairs of socks because we really don't know whether we're going to stabilize out particularly lower power settings in the spacecraft at low temperatures or comfortably or uncomfortably warm temperatures. So from this standpoint and the freedom standpoint, we'll be probably a lot more comfortable than we were in Gemini. During the EVA part, though, you brought out, I think that was the most comfortable part of my whole flight. Temperature-wise and freedom-wise during Gemini 4 was the time that I was out during the EVA. So I don't know whether I'll be that comfortable or not.
Well, you're indicating an opinion a bit different from some of the other fellows who've been inside this highly pressurized suit. That's not going anywhere. I'll just drop it there.
You mean of?
In other words, they're talking about how uncomfortable the pressure bladder and everything is. When you're pressurized, how hard it is to move around. Everybody talks about how uncomfortable and bulky the thing is. So.
Yeah, well, but out there, completely unencumbered by any weight, and also I wasn't doing some of the tough tasks that some of the later fellows tried to accomplish. I was comfortable out there. I didn't have too big a fight. I had a tough time with the hatch coming back in. That was a big job, trying to get it closed. But the maneuvering out there with the maneuvering unit there wasn't anything to be fighting out there. I was just floating free in space.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure you'd like to do that again, wouldn't you?
Yes, I will.
On another flight. Not on this one. You're going to stay inside on this one.
Well,
right?
They told me I had to stay in on this one.
Okay, thank you, Ed White. Halt one moment. We're about to run out of our time. Let's see if we can get this one and make it clean here somehow. Ed White,
I know what they're going to call during a flight. They're going to call it space tanks. I know that already, don't you?
Space tanks?
Yeah, it sure is a day, isn't it?
All right, let's see if I can try to get into it and still be clean. Well, Ed, you're going to carry out one of the interesting medical experiments on this flight, and that is wearing sort of a girdle or what we might end up calling space tights just before reentry. Explain to us what this is for and what they look like.
Well, it's really a very simple clinical device that they've used in the medical field for some years now. It's a supporting device, skin fitting and elastic from my waist all the way down to my feet, which hopefully will prevent pooling of blood in the lower extremities, which is the device that people pass out from. If the blood pools down in the lower extremities, the blood isn't permitted to get to the head and you can pass out.
It just maintains pressure on your legs and hips.
To keep the pressure of the blood high enough to keep it up in your head area. This is one of the things on Gemini 4 with the seating position in the Gemini spacecraft. They didn't know whether we would, in an upright position when we got down on the water, whether we would pass out and then not be able to regain consciousness because we'd stay upright. You have to fall down and get flat and let the blood go to your head.
Well, this is designed to see how it affects you at recovery, after reentry.
That's right. They want to see if this device used during the last 3 or 4 hours of the flight and during the reentry, and then I'll keep it on and go in and wear it during the post-flight medical testing and see if this has some effect. I don't know how I got selected for it. They told me it was because they had the most experience with my medically monitoring me from Gemini 4. They selected me for it, and they'll compare the data from this flight with the Gemini 4, and then they'll run some testing right after they complete this testing without it after the recovery, and then they'll compare this data.
Thank you very much, Ed White.
And our time, I didn't get a chance to say your name. Yeah. You hurried me through so fast.
This is off tape. Yeah. What do you want?
Tell him, and he'll catch it. Roger Chaffee, you are in the number 3 seat in our new Apollo spacecraft, and you're also a new name to many of our listeners. Could you tell us something about yourself? Where were you born in the United States?
I was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, on the 15th of February, 1935.
That makes you a fairly young man in this business and in flying in general, doesn't it?
Yes, it is. I'm 31. I'll be 32 here in a few days. I've been flying in the Navy for about 9 years now. I guess I'm pretty near the junior man in our office, with the exception of some of the new group of 19 astronauts that we just picked up about 6-8 months ago.
Michigan, that's in the Midwestern United States. It's sort of cold country, too, there, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's Midwest on the northern boundaries of the country, and we get a lot of snow, more than our share as far as I'm concerned when I'm up there. And it's pretty cold this time of year also.
Tell us something of your educational background and how you got into flying and then on into astronautics.
Well, we'll just assume I had the standard elementary and high school education, and then I decided I wanted to study aeronautical engineering. I went to Purdue University, which is in West Lafayette, Indiana, about 200 miles south of my home in Michigan. I graduated in 1957 with a bachelor's degree in aeronautical engineering. At that time, I was commissioned an ensign in the U.S. Navy and entered flight training. When I finished flight training, I spent 3.5, maybe 4 years in a squadron in Jacksonville, Florida, and was then chosen to go to postgraduate school on an exchange program with the Air Force. I entered the Air Force Institute of Technology at Dayton, Ohio, Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and started to work on my master's degree in reliability engineering.
We'll get to what that means a little later.
Right. All these years that I had been flying in the Navy, I say all these, all four or five of them by that time, I had been putting on my duty preference card, requesting test pilot school so I could be eligible for astronaut training, or requesting recommendation for astronaut training. And sure enough, one day in the mail, I got a letter from Bureau of Naval Personnel that says, "We will recommend you to NASA to try out for astronaut selection if you so desire."
Now, where were we in our space exploration program at that time?
This was about a month after Gordon Cooper's flight, the last Mercury flight. I believe his last Mercury flight was May...
63.
Of 63, I think around the 22nd of May, something like that, 1963. And I received this letter from the Navy, I think, on about the 13th of June. 1963.
So you were building your proficiency in naval aviation right at the time of the Mercury flights in space.
Yes, I was. I was getting most of my flight time and experience during the Mercury program. In fact, I was in a photographic squadron, and we provided high-altitude photographic coverage of the Mercury flights from our station in Jacksonville, Florida. I used to...
The launches?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I used to rendezvous at about... shall I say, orbited about 40,000 feet, 35 to 40,000 feet, standing by, and we'd fly a flight pattern to run in on the booster during the launch.
You were one of the chase planes.
One of the chase planes, right, and I took pictures of several of the flights between the altitudes of around 30 and 45,000 feet.
But you couldn't catch those things, could you?
No, there wasn't any danger of overrunning them. They always managed to get away from us.
An Atlas booster was a little faster than a jet airplane.
Yeah, they move out pretty good. So anyway, I was in this reliability program when the notice came from the Navy, and I filled out the papers and sent them in and went through the long selection process, which entails physical examinations, mental examinations, both the psychiatric variety of mental exams and also the engineering, or just the good old school type tests. Mm-hmm. Quite a few personal interviews with various people of NASA. And then one day the good word came, and I was chosen to come on board the astronaut team.
And when was that?
Well, I received notification in October 1963, and we all had to wrap up our duties in our respective squadrons or schools, wherever we were. And my group of astronauts reported on board in February of 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been in training down here since then, handling our various duties in the space program and preparing ourselves for flight.
You mentioned that you were an alumnus of Purdue University. I believe several other astronauts are Purdue men, aren't they?
Yes, they are. Gus Grissom, who's command pilot on the flight I'm going on, is a Purdue graduate. The next one, if we take them in order of seniority in the program, shall we say, or as who graduated first from Purdue, it's the same way. The next one is Neil Armstrong, who flew on Gemini 8. And the next one is Gene Cernan, who flew on Gemini 9. And Gene and I knew each other at Purdue, by the way, and we're next-door neighbors here in Houston. And then a year after Gene graduated from Purdue, I graduated from Purdue.
Mm-hmm. And who's your wife?
My wife is Martha, the former Martha Horn of Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. And I met her at Purdue University also.
And how many children you have, Roger?
Two. I have a girl 8 and a boy 5.
Okay. Hold on a minute, Doyle. I put a thank you on that to end it. Thanks very much, Roger, and we'll be talking to you more during the flight. Roger Chaffee, you are what is called the pilot in this first Apollo mission. Now, that means you're in the right-hand seat, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Now, what's over there? What can you see from your position there at takeoff in this big new Apollo spacecraft, besides a lot of space around you?
Well, at takeoff, actually, I won't see very much space or anything outside the spacecraft. I won't see anything. Let me say a few words on that. We have what we call a boost protective cover. You might think of it like a horse blanket. It's a big fabric-type material, very stiff, kind of a fiberglass-type composition that covers the outside of the spacecraft during the boost phase of flight. The reason for this is because of aerodynamic heating as you're boosting into orbit could scorch the paint on the outside of the spacecraft, start to heat up the ablative covering on the spacecraft. Unlike Gemini and Mercury, which had metal shingles that covered the outside, the Apollo spacecraft has the ablative material all around it, where the Gemini and Mercury just had it on the heat shield. And you don't want to get any preheating of this during boost.
So this ablative material that will burn off during the
boost. Right. And the reason the Apollo has it all over is because ultimately, of course, this vehicle will be coming in on lunar trajectories or lunar reentries, coming back from the moon.
A lot more speed, a lot more heat than previous.
A lot more speed, a lot more heat, and you need the ablative material all over. Well, we don't want to get this heated up during boost into orbit and start the ablation process on it at all. So we have this boost protective cover, and well, it just covers up the windows and everything. So until we get rid of our launch escape tower, as we call it, which is a spider-legged device that's up on top of the command module at launch, until we get rid of that, the windows are covered with this boost protective cover. And that goes off at about 2 minutes and 45 seconds after liftoff, and then, of course, we can see. As far as what I see inside the spacecraft from the right-hand seat during boost, the right-hand seat is... You might think of it as a watch station, or if you compare it with a big commercial-type airliner with the flight engineer station. All the systems are controlled and monitored from that station. The electrical system, the environmental control system, the communication systems, the propellant systems for the main engine, varying the mixture ratio of fuel and oxidizer to control combustion in your main engine.
Mm-hmm. Could you say then that Gus Grissom is the I was going to just reiterate the aviation comparison.
Well,
the captain of the ship.
Yeah.
Ed White's the co-pilot, and you are the engineer. I'll ask you this question. Then could you say that in comparing it to commercial aviation, Gus Grissom is the captain of the craft, Ed White is co-pilot, and you are the flight engineer. Is that a fair comparison?
Well, it looks something like that, yes, during liftoff. Gus has his hands, you might say, on the controls if he was to take over, say, for an abort or to do attitude control manually during boost or shortly after insertion. Ed is really at what we call the navigation station, but he is sitting next to Gus and can assist him in some of his functions, similar to what a co-pilot does for a captain during takeoff or landing. And then I'm running the systems during this time.
Well, this is very interesting because this is new to us to understand, and also it's nice to have something to compare it to, like a big commercial airliner, which is much more down to earth and within our knowledge sphere.
Yes, I think most people are familiar with the operation or what they've seen pictures and that of insides of the commercial airliners and know the seats. One thing I want to make clear on this or point out is the way we rotate duties during flight. So we want to associate the names command pilot, senior pilot, and pilot more with order of authority or responsibility on board. The command pilot makes all the decisions, of course, like the captain of a ship. If anything were to happen to him, the next man in line would be the senior pilot and then the pilot. And even though we rotate seats during the flight so that we exchange duties, the names don't stay with the seats. The names stay with the people.
Mm-hmm.
Even if Gus is in the right seat, monitoring systems, and I'm in the left seat actually controlling the spacecraft, doing an orbit change burning maneuver where we're thrusting with the main engine. And we do this, we rotate, but Gus is still the command pilot over there.
Mm-hmm.
If it came a decision of whether we're going to do that burn or whether we're not, or the decision is, to talk about any of the major things that can come up, that would be his decision, regardless of who is in the left seat flying it at that time. Of course, once you actually start the flight maneuver, then who's ever doing it, of course, is going to have to make any real-time decisions that come along, because everything happens pretty fast. Once that engine lights off, there's not much time. You've got to be prepared for it.
What does systems engineering mean? Is it the integrating of all of the new instruments and so forth into one whole unit? This is sort of
Are you speaking of that with respect to inside the spacecraft, or just the term systems engineering as far as our engineers here in the Apollo program office and at Downey at North American speak of it?
Well, let's apply it to the spacecraft.
Well, okay, the systems engineer applied to the spacecraft is actually, literally, it's just what it says. He is a man that controls the various systems that make the spacecraft go. One system is the electrical system. We have two AC buses, three inverters to produce AC electricity. We have...
A bus is a main channel. That's
explained. Right, a main channel of power distribution. We have eight DC buses, direct current buses. And our equipment is split up between all these various buses into subsystems of the electrical system. These buses and loads that go on them, various pieces of equipment, have to be switched at different times during the flight. Sometimes you have to bring additional inverters on the line to carry the AC load. Our DC current is generated from fuel cells, where we combine hydrogen and oxygen in a catalytic or with a catalyst to produce a reaction, and they produce electricity and water. We drink the water afterwards, by the way. We use that for our main water supply. Well, that's another system then, the fuel cell system. And then we have the cryogenic system. This
the
is the
super cold.
The super cold oxygen and hydrogen, which supplies the reactants to the fuel cells. And then we have the environmental control system, which keeps the temperature right in the spacecraft for the crew. It keeps the temperature of all the equipment at the proper operating temperature. This is done by space radiators. We circulate water glycol mixture through the radiators to cool it.
That's sort of an antifreeze, isn't it?
Well, the glycol is the antifreeze, yes, and ours is just about what you'd have in an automobile radiator as far as composition of water glycol. And then we bring this back from the radiators through some pumps, a distribution system, and circulate it through cold plates, as we call them. And these are just hollow metal plates. The water glycol circulates through it, and the black box or the electronic equipment is bolted on top of it, and it keeps it cool. The environmental control system also provides all our breathing oxygen. It handles our water distribution. It heats our water for hot water to mix with some of our dehydrated food if we want it hot. It chills some water, so we have very cold drinking water, which makes it a little more palatable, of course. And it handles the waste management system.
Mm-hmm.
Then we have the communication system. This is also run from the system station and requires a little bit of switching during some of these maneuvers when you're over in that seat. We have two VHF voice links and an S-band voice link.
These are radar units. You say C...
Well, the C-band is really our radar for tracking only. The S-band is everything. We call it the unified S-band equipment.
I got it started in the wrong track. Mm-hmm. Track on that completely. I'll just let it go where you said in VHF and S-band, and just let it go.
Okay.
Because I don't want to get into the depths of
the
radar overseas and stuff. Well, Roger, we ask you about systems and about engineering to begin with there, because I happen to have, because in the past I noticed that you have been aggressive in working on engineering problems. I've heard you be quite strongly I've heard you express your opinions quite strongly on some of the systems and problems that you've had to overcome in the past, and so I just got the impression that you were quite aggressive in working out problems when it comes to systems engineering.
Oh, I see. Well, my background, my training, of course, was to be an engineer and a pilot, and I like both of them very much, and so I enjoy getting in and tackling a good down-to-earth practical engineering problem that comes along.
Thank you, Roger Chaffee. Hold it a minute, Doyle. Just a minute.
Yeah.
Roger Chaffee, you have been watching the experiments package rather closely for this Apollo mission. Could you run through the scientific, medical, and technical experiments which are to be conducted on the mission?
Sure, I'd be glad to. We're not as heavily loaded with experiments as some of the Gemini flights have been, but we have quite a few, or several, I should say, and they're all important to the space program. Of course, the biggest experiment's the spacecraft itself, and that's the big objective of the first flight of any new vehicle or new spacecraft, is to prove that it's going to work. And so we have about 60 or 70 objectives that we call experiments, because they're handled the same way we did experiments in Gemini. A specific time in the flight, we go in and we do a specific maneuver or a specific systems test. Maybe it takes an hour, maybe it takes 5 minutes, maybe 10 hours. But this is to pull an experiment, you might say, on a certain system or a certain piece of equipment in the spacecraft. Now, in addition to the mission objectives type experiments, we have about 7 medical experiments, 3 of which take onboard or real-time participation by the flight crew during the flight itself. The others are just pre- and post-flight blood analysis, calcium depletion of the bone analysis, conditioning, that's actual physical conditioning of the crew, things like that. Mm-hmm. So they just require a little testing beforehand and testing after the flight. The 3 medical experiments that require participation in flight is a otolith experiment, as we call it, where it's trying to see if there's any disturbance to the inner ear due to the lack of gravity, and this is what controls a person's balance, sense of direction, you might say. It's to see if we can become disoriented with goggles over our eyes where we can't see the, say, the control panel of the spacecraft. We lose our sight reference. One of the other ones is a it's a lower body support garment. It's a known fact, if people spend a great deal of time in bed, in bed rest, then when they get up, blood tends to pool in their legs from lack of, shall we say, muscle tone or exercise during long periods. Well, it's been hypothesized that this might happen to astronauts over long periods of flight. So if we run this flight for 14 days, say, there's a possibility this could happen. They wanted to check this, and there's been some of this noted in the past.
Now, we've jokingly called it Ed White's girdle, haven't
we? Right, and Ed's going to wear this support garment, and you can think of it as a girdle. It's a full-length girdle, though, that runs from his ankles to his midsection, a very tight, elastic garment. And Ed will put this garment on about 5 hours prior to reentry and wear it until after he's back on the ship. And they will compare how it reacts or how he reacts this time compared to how he reacted on his last flight when he didn't wear this. Okay. Then the other one is just monitoring of the heart noise. They'll compare the noise of the heart to the electrical impulse of the heart. It's a pretty straightforward one.
That's been done before.
Yes,
in Gemini.
Yes, it has. Then we have what we call one technical experiment, and it's just an aerosol or a particle sampler. It takes in a sample of air, and it counts how many particles are of a certain size or in so much volume of air. It's to determine how good our environmental control system is at cleaning up the spacecraft.
The new unit for the new spacecraft.
Right, that's exactly it. Then we have, of course, our scientific experiments. We have 4 of them, and they're all photographic. The 2 old Gemini standbys, Synoptic Terrain and Synoptic Weather Photography. And then we have a dim light photography, which is trying to get photographs of sunrise and sunset, the air glow layer. Then we have a international experiment that's going to be done with the French government, and this is a sodium vapor cloud photographic experiment.
Thank you, Roger Chaffee. Then just the vapor cloud itself.
Yeah.
Roger, we tried this. Roger, we tried to photograph this sodium vapor cloud during the Gemini 12 mission, and it was very difficult for the astronauts to see. This is to be done again on the first Apollo flight. Could you explain how we hope to have success this time, how you can align the spacecraft better in this case?
This experiment was tried on Gemini 12, and we're going to try it again on our flight. And I think the flight crew is very excited about this one for two reasons. One is we're working with another country on it. It takes a lot of cooperation. Our control center at Houston is talking with the control center at Hamaguir with the French.
That's in North Africa.
Right. And they're coordinating times. We're telling the French when we'll be at a certain point in space, and they're going to launch their rockets, which will leave a sodium vapor trail. Let's see, I think it's going to be between about 70 and 200 miles. Now, this rocket's being launched, and we're about 650 miles away, 1,000 kilometers.
That's about 100 to 300 kilometers up into space, right?
Right, and we'll be about 1,000 kilometers away when they launch this. Now, the big problem in this experiment is trying to see it. They had some goggles on Gemini 12, and since then, the goggles have been improved. These goggles let you just see a certain wavelength or a certain color of light, and it tries to blank out some of the other colors of light in the spectrum.
As I recall, the desert is very bright. The bright Sahara there almost overwhelms light from everything else.
Right, it does. It makes this cloud very hard to see, but with these goggles and the improved ones that we have on this flight, I think we'll have a better chance of seeing the cloud ourselves. Plus, the big advantage of Apollo and the way we can pick this up is we can align our stable platform or our inertial unit an hour or two before the launch, say on the previous orbit. We'll have this all aligned as we're coming up for this sodium rocket. And we'll have this platform aligned on the star, so it'll be very accurate. Well, then the ground, by knowing the location where they're going to launch it and the flight path, the French will generate sighting angles from our orbit, exact direction we can point our spacecraft with respect to this stable platform that we have aligned on the stars. So as we're coming up from Bermuda across the Atlantic Ocean, we'll fly to this attitude and have our windows pointed right at the place in space where this cloud is to be emitted. In the event that we don't see anything, we'll go ahead and start our cameras rolling at the precise time that the French tell us to, and we'll take one exposure every second for a period of about 5 minutes here. And so I'm quite confident we'll get something off this, because if we're pointed in the right direction and we're taking a picture every second, if the cloud's there, we'll get some pictures of it.
Well, can you explain what the study of the vapor cloud is for? What's the scientific purpose?
Okay, they're really trying to measure extremely high winds, winds at altitudes that people don't fly at in airplanes even today. Winds up around 100 miles and the movement of the atmosphere.
160 kilometers
right.
Up.
And they'll have this vapor trail up there, and over a five-minute period, it will be displaced in the photographs, and they'll be able to get their measurements off this of what the direction and velocity
following
the currents
cloud.
Are, right, by following it. Then on the next revolution around, where there should be some remnants or traces of the cloud on the experiment and what the purpose was, and we sat there and talked about